Okay, we're recording. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Thomas Mann, and I just learned some details about his background. So I already knew that he had two master's degrees. He has an ME in education, an MA in Spanish literature, so he's about to get his MS. I did tell him many times that he could be doing a PhD, and when you see the extent of what he initially had in mind for his studies here, you'll understand why it could have been a PhD. But what I didn't know until just now is that when he started undergrad, he was pre-med. So I've been collecting little stories from other people about what they thought they wanted to do when they started undergrad. And his journey took him through Spanish, through teaching Spanish in Colorado, to some exposure to forests, forest ecology. I thank Mary Arthur for his remedial semester in forest ecology education at University of Kentucky. He came here. Russ, put some words in the chat about what it's like to have a TA who actually has a degree in education. He's been with us for just 2 years, but it included 2 years on the summer crew work in New Hampshire. You'll hear more about that, including the famous year of COVID. Thomas is a competent and responsible. And we gave him way too much to do, and he's managed to carve out a very impressive piece of that for this project. But I feel so lucky to have had him curating and taking care of some of our long-term data sets, more than one of which I'm sure will eventually see its way to publication. So I want, if you can unmute for a few seconds and just, I want to hear us welcome Thomas, and Thomas, share your screen, and take it away.
Okay. Yeah, just so we don't get any wacky feedback stuff, try to make sure that you're muted if you haven't already. All right. Thumbs up if you can see my screen. Ready? Cool. All right, so thanks for the introduction, Ruth. As Ruth mentioned, my project explored both soil respiration and even began with litter fall, so it was ambitious, and I was grateful to Ruth and to the lab group for giving me the opportunity to take that on. And I'm excited to share with you what we found here today. So when it comes to soil respiration and litter fall, both of those components are important fluxes in the global carbon cycle. And this graphic illustrates the many pools and fluxes of that cycle. So pools can be thought of as reserves of carbon, locations where carbon is temporarily locked up as it moves through the carbon cycle. Pools include trees and other vegetation, soils, fossil fuel reserves, the atmosphere, and all of the other little colored dots that you can see in this figure. Fluxes are the processes by which carbon moves from one pool to another, and these are represented by arrows in this graphic. Fossil fuel emissions are probably the most well-known carbon flux these days, but there are also other carbon fluxes, more natural carbon fluxes that move carbon from one pool to another, such as this one here. And for this talk, I'm going to be zooming in on just this one small part of the global carbon cycle, which I've represented with this little box here. So the arrow within this box represents the movement of carbon from terrestrial ecosystems into the atmospheric pool of carbon dioxide. So when we zoom in on that flux, it's natural to wonder, where does that carbon dioxide come from? And the answer to that question is respiration. So let's talk a little bit about respiration. In grade school, we learned that plants use photosynthesis to create their own energy, and along the way, they convert oxygen to carbon dioxide. We call plants autotrophs because they make their own energy themselves, and I'll be using that term throughout this presentation. Here we have a little graphic representation showing what's going on in photosynthesis, right? The conversion of carbon dioxide to oxygen and the production of energy sources along the way. We can think of respiration as being the inverse of that process. Organisms that can't make their own energy respire in order to make use of the energy sources originally created by plants. In the process, they convert oxygen back into carbon dioxide. So there's a little overview of respiration. We call these organisms that cannot make their own energy heterotrophs. And something they may not have told you in grade school is that plants respire too, as they make use of the energy sources that they created through photosynthesis. So respiration is happening not only by these heterotrophs, but also by autotrophs. So in the terrestrial ecosystems that we're focusing on here, or ecosystems based on land, respiration occurs both above and below ground. Above ground sources include autotrophs, which, as I mentioned, respire as they consume energy sources created through photosynthesis. Above ground sources of carbon dioxide include heterotrophs as well. Heterotrophs include you, me, this chipmunk here. We're all heterotrophs conducting respiration and contributing carbon dioxide to the atmospheric pool. Respiration also occurs below ground. For autotrophs, those include roots. And for heterotrophs, below ground carbon respiration includes fungi, bacteria, or other organisms decomposing or consuming sources of carbon within the soil. So for this project, I just focused on soil respiration, which we define as the total efflux or release of carbon dioxide from soils, including both heterotrophic and autotrophic sources. Soil respiration contributes as much as 70% of all the carbon dioxide released from terrestrial ecosystems. Put another way, soil respiration accounts for about 40% of all the natural fluxes of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. In short, it's an enormous source of atmospheric carbon dioxide, and it's critical that we understand it well if we hope to have a complete understanding of the global carbon cycle. So if soil respiration is such an important component of the global carbon cycle, what are factors that control it? Those factors differ between autotrophs and heterotrophs. One control of autotrophic soil respiration is metabolic activity. Generally speaking, we can think of this as being a temperature control. Over the course of the year, as temperatures increase from winter to spring and then to summer, plants become more active. As their metabolic activity increases, the rate at which they release carbon dioxide in respiration increases as well. Trees' smallest roots, which we call fine roots, are the most metabolically active, releasing carbon dioxide at a greater rate than coarse roots, the larger roots, on a per mass basis. The availability of nutrients within soils is also correlated with rates of autotrophic respiration. Specifically, higher levels of available nitrogen result in higher rates of soil respiration due to increases in the biomass of fine roots. For heterotrophs, soil respiration is also controlled by metabolic activity. As temperature increases, the rate of carbon dioxide released by heterotrophs increases as well. It is also controlled by how easily carbon within the soil can be decomposed. Soils containing high quantities of easily decomposable carbon tend to have higher rates of soil respiration. And finally, heterotrophic respiration is controlled by how much carbon is allocated below ground by trees. This is an important concept here, so we're going to discuss that a little further. Below ground carbon allocation is used to describe the amount of carbon that ends up in the soil as a result of the activity of trees. For example, think of all the carbon that ends up below ground as a result of root growth. That is one enormously important component of below ground carbon allocation. Another component of below ground carbon allocation is the maintenance of the fungal communities or mycorrhizae associated with roots. During the growing season, trees transport some of the energy sources they produce in photosynthesis to mycorrhizae. This sustains those fungi, which in turn help to transport water to tree roots and make mineral resources in the soil more readily available for uptake. Resource optimization theory would suggest that when nutrients are abundant, like we see here, fewer resources are allocated below ground to to microbial communities. And therefore, microbial respiration is slower too. However, when nutrients are few, plants invest heavily in the mycorrhizal communities that help them to acquire resources, and below ground heterotrophic respiration increases. So to recap all of this, soil respiration is the largest component of the terrestrial carbon cycle, constituting about 70% of it. Soil respiration itself consists of autotrophic and heterotrophic components, and the heterotrophic component slightly outpaces the autotrophic component in terms of their contributions to soil respiration. Soil respiration is controlled by a wide range of ecosystem processes and conditions, including rates of metabolic activity, below ground carbon allocation, and nutrient availability. So if resource optimization theory suggests that soil respiration would be lower under nutrient-rich conditions, does research support that claim? Let's start by looking at how nitrogen affects soil respiration. So forest productivity in the northeastern United States is thought to be nitrogen limited. In other words, if more nitrogen were present in northeastern forests, they would be more productive and would be able to grow more quickly. However, decades of nitrogen deposition have greatly altered nutrient conditions in the northeastern United States. The map to the right here illustrates the amount of nitrogen that has been added to the landscape as a result of human activity. If forests are indeed nitrogen limited, this anthropogenic addition would be expected to relieve the extent to which forest productivity is limited by nitrogen. Furthermore, they could be expected to affect a wide range of ecosystem processes. So to test for the effect of nitrogen additions on ecosystems, a number of nitrogen addition experiments have been conducted to determine the potential impacts of this change. One of those studies was the Harvard Forest Chronic Nitrogen Amendment Study, where nitrogen was added at two different rates to forests in western Massachusetts. While that nitrogen was being added, researchers followed rates of soil respiration to see how they were affected by nitrogen additions. In the first 2 years, they saw an initial pulse in soil respiration in response to nitrogen addition, which we can see reflected in the plot here to the left. Rates of soil respiration in control plots, represented by dots in the solid line, so kind of here if you can follow my mouse, tend to be below the nitrogen addition lines in the first year, which ends about here. In the second year, the control line is below the low rate of nitrogen addition, but above the high rate of nitrogen addition. So kind of eking along here. Following that pulse in soil respiration during the first 2 years of the study, nitrogen suppressed soil respiration. So the plot on the right illustrates soil respiration 13 years into the study. In this case, the control line, again represented by dots in the solid line, tends to be above the low rate and the high rate of nitrogen addition. So if long-term nitrogen addition suppress soil respiration, what might be the effect on other nutrients? This is one of the primary guiding questions of my research, and an important question within the multiple element limitation in Northern Hardwood Ecosystem Study that I've been lucky enough to be a part of. That name, multiple element limitation in Northern Hardwood Ecosystems, is a mouthful, so I'll be abbreviating that MELNIHI throughout this talk. The MELNIHI study was established in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in 2009. A good 6.5 hour drive away from Syracuse, and even longer for some of our collaborators at Cornell or Miami of Ohio. The goal of the MELNIHI project is to explore how both nitrogen and phosphorus control ecosystem processes. In doing so, we would be able to dig deeper into the supposed nitrogen limitation of northeastern forests and see to what extent forest productivity was limited by phosphorus. The MELNIHI study includes 13 forest stands across the White Mountain National Forest. And in the map to the right, we have a representation of one of those 13 stands. So when I say stand, over the course of this talk, picture this, a collection of four squares or plots. As you can see, each stand includes four plots represented by the white, blue, red, and purple squares seen here. Each of those plots are 50 meters by 50 meters, so you can imagine this particular stand to be a little larger than the length of two football fields. In 2011, the first nutrient treatments were made across these four plots. One plot received nitrogen, coated by blue, another phosphorus, coated by red, another both nitrogen and phosphorus, coated purple, and another no nutrient addition. This control plot is coated white. Those nutrient treatments have been repeated annually every year since, making the Malnahe study the longest running full factorial N-by-P manipulation experiment in a temperate ecosystem. Another mouthful. So here are a few highlights from the Malnahe project. We detected phosphorus limitation of tree diameter growth as opposed to N. We detected nitrogen limitation of fine root growth in the absence of phosphorus addition. And with regard to soil respiration, an early study in 2012 and 2013 found that while soil respiration was suppressed by nitrogen addition in plots where nitrogen mineralization was low, it was enhanced by nitrogen addition in plots where nitrogen mineralization was high. So my specific contribution to the Malnahe project was the analysis of the long-term soil respiration data set, stretching from 2009 until 2020. I also contributed to 2020 measurements of soil respiration, which is the most complete year of post-treatment data with measurements spanning from April to November. So the questions we were seeking to answer with this research were, how is soil respiration affected by the addition of nitrogen and phosphorus? How does the age of a forest stand affect soil respiration? And if these effects are detected, do they vary throughout the year? In other words, do they vary by season? Or do they interact with one another? So now I'll outline the methods of this study, offering a little more detail for some of the specifics of the Malnahe study. Malnahe stands are distributed unevenly across three sites, Bartlett Experimental Forest, Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, and Jeffers Brook. Three successional stages are represented among those 13 stands. We have early successional stages, which were cut about 31 to 33 years ago. Mid-successional stands cut 36 to 41 years ago, and mature stands cut 82 to 128 years ago. Soil carbon dioxide fluxes were measured at 5 to 7 locations within each treatment plot across all 13 stands. You can see here in this picture the instrument that was used to do that, and our trusty field technician, Brendan, who helped collect a lot of the 2020 measurements as well. In most years, measurements were made June through August, but in some years, measurements were made as early as March and as late as November. Data were grouped into periods in order to test whether the effects we detected changed over time. So those are those periods there. We also analyzed spring, summer, and fall measurements separately in order to test for seasonal effects. And finally, a bit for all the stats heads out there, this analysis was conducted using a repeated measures analysis of variance to compare treatment means and to test for interactions. Fixed effects included a pretreatment covariate, soil temperature, an interaction term that included nitrogen addition, phosphorus addition, stand age class, and year. And they are listed there. And random effects included plot, nested within stand, nested within site. Okay, so let's get on to the results. I'll start with nitrogen effects, followed by phosphorus, stand age, and then we'll look at an interaction effect between nitrogen and phosphorus. So here we have a table showing the p-values of nitrogen effects on soil respiration. I'm going to be sharing a few of these tables, so I'm going to take a second to describe what we're looking at here. Running left to right in these rows here are the analysis periods into which the data were divided. And the rows correspond to different treatment effects that you can see over here. Empty cells indicate that the treatment effect on the left was not significant at an alpha of 0.1 for that analysis period. Cells highlighted dark green, such as most of these here, have a p-value of less than 0.05, and cells highlighted light green have a p-value less than 0.1. In short, we can think of the green cells as indicating that there's something worth investigating further in that analysis period with regard to that treatment effect. So let's start by taking a look at these top two rows, the main effect of nitrogen addition and an interaction between nitrogen and year. These p-values indicate that nitrogen consistently affected soil respiration. And when we look into the data further, we find that nitrogen consistently suppresses soil respiration after an initial pulse in the spring of 2012. So let's explore that a little bit. The table on the left and the plot on the right show the same data. In spring 2012, nitrogen addition enhanced soil respiration 32% relative to control plots. But as continued nitrogen additions were made, soil respiration is suppressed more and more, bottoming out, so to speak, at a reduction of 14% relative to controls. You might recall that this is very similar to the nitrogen effect detected in the Harvard Forest study, so nothing too surprising here. If we return to the nitrogen effects table and take a look at these bottom two rows, these significant interactions indicate that the effect of nitrogen depended on other factors included in the study. For example, the nitrogen by stand age interaction detected in summer data from 2018 through 2020, so here, tells us that the effect of nitrogen depended on stand age. The bottom row, an interaction between nitrogen, stand age, and year, takes that a step further. It tells us that the interaction between nitrogen and stand age varied across years within a given analysis period. So this plot illustrates those effects. Lines here represent stand age, with the dotted line representing early successional or young stands, so recently cut. The dashed line represents mid-successional or slightly older stands, and the solid line represents mature stands. The y-axis shows the magnitude and direction of the nitrogen effect. The first takeaway here is that with the exception of mature stands in 2018, this little bump here, nitrogen reduced soil respiration across all stand age classes. The second takeaway is that in 2015 through 2017, after about 5 to 7 years of nutrient additions, how stand age influenced the nitrogen effect was inconsistent. Sometimes nitrogen had the strongest effect on soil respiration in mid-successional stands, as we see here. Other times there was no nitrogen had no effect on soil respiration at all, as we see here. However, beginning in 2018, the nitrogen effect becomes particularly pronounced in early successional stands. And it remains that way throughout the rest of the analysis period. So the nitrogen effect in the last 3 years of the study was strongest in early successional stands. Let's take a look now at phosphorus effects. So these p-values indicate that phosphorus likely affected soil respiration in the summer analysis period of 2015 through 2017, represented by this column. But the nature of that effect depended on stand age and even varied from year to year. Let's take a closer look. This plot is organized the same way as the nitrogen plot before. So we see that phosphorus addition here enhanced soil respiration in both early successional and mid-successional stands in the summer data from 2015 and 2016. The difference across stand age classes in 2017 was not significant. Taking a look at stand age effects, we can see that effects were detected in 7 of the 8 analysis periods following the first year of nutrient additions. So 7 of these 8 analysis periods here. The stand age by year interaction in the second row indicates that within some analysis periods, the nature of the stand age effect changed from 1 year to the next. So this enormous, kind of intimidating plot shows stand age data from every analysis period. Years are organized into columns and seasons into rows. The p-values for the main effect of stand age within each analysis period can be found in the upper right-hand corner of each frame. The box plots show how the data were distributed within each age class, and the points in the background represent individual plot averages. It's a lot to take in, but if you can focus on either the median value, represented by the dark black line running across each box, or the average value, represented by the gray diamond within the box, you can kind of start to read the trend that's present here. I want to highlight just those analysis periods in which the stand age effect had a p-value of less than 0.1. So if we take a closer look at these analysis periods that are highlighted in red here, we see that sole respiration tended to be greatest in early successional stands, followed by mature stands, then mid-successional stands. Here we can see those analysis periods with significant stand age main effects. So I've kind of taken out the ones that were highlighted red in the previous plot. And we see that trend that I was describing before. Typically, early successional stands have the highest sole respiration, followed by mature stands, and then mid-successional stands in last. It's worth noting, however, that post-hoc analysis of these group contrasts did not indicate significant groupings. Finally, we'll take a look at the nitrogen and phosphorus interaction, which is probably the most exciting finding from this analysis. So in the summer and fall of 2012 and 2014, a significant interaction between nitrogen and phosphorus was detected. And the low p-value of 0.02 indicates that we can be fairly confident in the presence of this effect. Before we look into that effect further, remember that with the exception of spring 2012, nitrogen consistently suppressed soil respiration. This interaction effect that we see here on this slide tells us that that effect will be different in the presence of phosphorus. So let's take a look. This plot is similar to the one before for stand age, with years as columns and seasons as rows, only this time data are grouped by nutrient treatment rather than stand age class. The black boxes represent control plots, blue boxes nitrogen, red phosphorus, and purple nitrogen plus phosphorus. The number in the top right corner is the p-value of the nitrogen by phosphorus interaction effect tested for that analysis period. These two frames highlighted in red were the only ones in which that p-value was lower than 0.1. It's very hard to see the effect here because it's all scrunched up. So let's zoom in to see how nitrogen and phosphorus interact to affect soil respiration. Remember that in these box plots, black bars represent median values and gray diamonds represent average values. So looking at these visualizations, we can clearly see that plots treated with just nitrogen had lower rates of soil respiration than control plots. So comparing those two diamonds and these two. If we compare plots receiving nitrogen and phosphorus to those receiving just phosphorus, we should see that nitrogen has the same suppressive effect, but we don't, indicating that there's an interaction between nitrogen and phosphorus going on here.
I should be real loud too.
Tom Mann, you might need to mute yourself. Thanks.
Just laughing.
Thanks. So plots receiving both nitrogen and phosphorus look nearly indistinguishable from those receiving just phosphorus. These two gray dots, nearly identical, right? This tells us that the effect of nitrogen depends upon phosphorus. We can see this even more clearly by looking at simple and main effects. For folks with less exposure to statistics, we can think of simple and main effects as looking at the effect of nitrogen when phosphorus is not added and comparing it to the effect of nitrogen when phosphorus is added. So regardless of your statistical background, I think these can be a little tricky to wrap your head around, but they are summarized in the chart to the left. Here we have two columns, one for the summer data from 2012 through 2014, and one for the fall data from 2012 through 2014. In each of those seasons, we have a column showing the main effect of nitrogen and another showing the simple effect of nitrogen addition with and without added phosphorus. So the takeaway here is that when nitrogen is added without phosphorus, it has a large suppressive effect on soil respiration. However, when phosphorus is added as well, the effect of nitrogen is almost entirely neutralized in both summer and fall. So to recap, In those results for nitrogen, we saw suppression of soil respiration after an initial pulse in the spring of 2012. The effect of nitrogen depended on stand age, but the nature of that effect varied from year to year, with early successional stands emerging as being most strongly affected by nitrogen in the last 3 years of the study. We saw that phosphorus briefly enhanced soil respiration, but only in early successional stands in the summer of 2015 and 2016. So that effect had a pretty limited scope, and it had a relatively high p-value of 0.07. For stand age, we saw that soil respiration tended to be greatest in early successional stands, followed by mature stands, then mid-successional stands. And for our nitrogen and phosphorus interaction, we saw that the magnitude of the nitrogen effect depended upon phosphorus availability, with phosphorus reducing the magnitude of the nitrogen effect. However, that effect was only detected in spring and fall data from 2012 through 2014. So what do we make of all this? Let's start with the stand age effect. The stand age effect detected here, that soil respiration was greatest in early successional stands, followed by mature, then mid-successional stands, does not fit neatly into previous explanations of the effect of stand age on soil respiration. In fact, outcomes of investigation into that question have been kind of inconsistent, with some studies reporting positive relationships between stand age and soil respiration, and others the opposite. Studies that show an increase in soil respiration with stand age explain that effect by way of fine root biomass. In other words, as trees grow and as their fine root biomass increases, autotrophic respiration increases as well. Studies that have found negative relationships between stand age and soil respiration attribute that effect to the relatively high soil temperatures in young stands. After a forest stand has been harvested, the soil system is exposed to greater amounts of sunlight, causing an increase in soil temperatures. This causes the metabolic activity of the heterotrophs and the fine roots living there to increase as well in response to those higher temperatures. As the stand ages and the soil surface becomes better shaded by leaves, soil temperatures decrease, causing rates of soil respiration to fall accordingly. Given that the Melnahy study began after our early successional stands were well into the stem exclusion phase, it's unlikely that the increased sunlight on the forest floor would explain high rates of soil respiration in young stands. Furthermore, we found no effect of stand age on soil temperature, so that potential mechanism can basically be ruled out. The high rates of soil respiration in early successional stands in our study could be attributed to the high degree of competition for resources. So going back to the resource optimization theory, if trees in densely populated young stands are competing very intensely for resources, they may allocate large amounts of carbon below ground, carbon that is ultimately respired as carbon dioxide in soil respiration. Alternatively, clear cutting often results in large amounts of slash or decomposable material being left behind in the stand. The decomposition of this material could explain higher rates of soil respiration seen in our early successional stands. Let's take a look at our nitrogen and phosphorus effects. So it's not earth-shattering news that nitrogen suppressed soil respiration or that the magnitude of that main effect increased over time to what appears to be an upper limit of about 14%. Such an effect is pretty similar to what was seen in the Harvard Forest study mentioned before, where nitrogen reduced soil respiration 15%. So to explain that suppression, a few different mechanisms have been proposed. We explored previously the first mechanism, which is perhaps the most popular and widely accepted, that when nitrogen is added, there is reduced investment in nutrient acquisition. Less carbon is allocated below ground to help trees acquire nutrients from their environment, so less carbon is respired to the atmosphere. Another potential explanation for the nitrogen effect is reduced microbial diversity and biomass in response to nitrogen addition. If nitrogen negatively affects the below ground heterotrophic community, then we can expect less heterotrophic respiration, which would, in turn, cause a reduction in soil respiration. But the significant nitrogen and phosphorus interaction detected in our study raises this question: why would the nitrogen effect change in the presence of added phosphorus? So to help make sense of that question, we can start by looking at what the Melnahy study has already shown us. As mentioned before, in 2011 through 2015, phosphorus additions increased tree diameter growth. Additionally, in 2013 through 2015, nitrogen additions increased fine root growth, but only in the absence of added P. So perhaps under the addition of nitrogen alone, fine root growth is the best investment of resources for trees needing to acquire nutrients from the below ground system. In this case, less carbon is allocated to heterotrophs, and therefore the primary contributors to soil respiration respire less. But perhaps when both nitrogen and phosphorus are added, the presence of phosphorus enhances photosynthetic activity, allowing for more efficient growth and allocation to mycorrhizae. In this case, allocation to mycorrhizae ends up being the best investment for resource acquisition. So heterotrophs receive more carbon and the effect of nitrogen addition is diminished. So in conclusion, the nature of the effect of nitrogen addition on soil respiration is more complex than we previously thought. And the role of phosphorus in soil respiration needs further exploration, especially given the enormous role that soil respiration plays in the global carbon cycle. These findings are exciting, especially the nitrogen by phosphorus interaction, but a lot of work remains to be done to identify specifically what's going on here. We need to explore how the nitrogen and phosphorus affect allocation to mycorrhizae and the rhizosphere in general, how they might affect microbial biomass, and whether the efficiency of photosynthesis under nutrient additions may help to explain some of the effects seen here. Additionally, further exploration into the high rates of soil respiration in early successional stands is warranted as well. Fortunately, the Melnahy study is a great context for answering these questions moving forward. That's all I have. Thank you for being here, and many thanks to Ruth, to my committee, all the Melnahy team that's here and come before us for their contributions to this project. Thanks.
All right, Thomas, I see some virtual clapping, but if anybody wants to unmute and clap, we're fine.
My camera just stopped working, but I am clapping for you, Thomas.
Thanks, Sam.
And we have time for some questions. So you can pop questions in the chat. You can just unmute yourself and ask a question, or you can put your hand up and hope that I call on you. So let me open the chat window.
Should I kill the background or do we like looking at the trees here?
Somebody I may have missed it, Thomas. You may have talked about this, but do you have any ideas about why this N by P interaction was transient? So it occurred in year 2, 3, 4, but then it disappeared.
Yeah, that's something that I've thought about. I didn't offer any thoughts on that during the presentation. I've wondered to what extent that's happening with like other things that we're seeing in the study. Some folks in the room here will know that I've been looking at like germinants, for example, and we saw some, you know, transient effects with germinants as well. So maybe, you know, this disruption, like an initial disruption to the system, causes these effects, and then with continued exposure to these elevated nitrogen and phosphorus conditions, plants adapt in such a way that causes the effect to disappear is the best guess that I have right now, but would love to hear more thoughts on that.
Ooh, I can ask a question about that. What would have the right time frame to adjust in that? And anybody who wants to can jump in. And Thomas, is that okay if I invite other people to join us?
Yeah.
You know, how fast should a microbe adjust as opposed to a root as opposed to the tree, understanding that its nutrient balance is out of whack. And we want this to occur by, thank you, Tim, this is years 2 to 4 that we saw this transient effect.
Yeah. So you're asking, like, where exactly would that adaptation be happening?
Yeah, I feel like Melanie's thought about this, but she's not with us. No, Mike, I just feel like microbes should adapt faster than trees.
Oh.
Like, you know, Tim, Andy, Claudia, how fast should a mycorrhizae adapt to a changing nutrient environment? What year was it that you saw differences in fruiting body?
That was 2018. You know, I would expect season to season there would be differences in mycorrhizal fungi. But yeah, I would say that the tree's microbiome will shift before the tree's, you know, root to shoot ratio will shift.
I see Andy in the chat bar. He says his Wi-Fi is not good enough to talk, but he says microbial communities can change seasonally. So I would imagine they should exhibit a faster change to nutrient additions than the root. I have a hard question, and I'll ask you this again. In your defense, you grouped these, and so now we're thinking hard about years 2, 3, and 4. But how confident are we that years 2, if you had grouped them a different way, would we be talking about why years 3, 4, and 5 had this effect, or 1, 2, and 3? Or it's important to how we interpret them that you chose to group them this way.
Yeah. One thing that makes me feel like a little bit better about that is that we had year interacting with the NNP interaction. So I would expect that, you know, if we saw an NNP interaction in one year and then not in the next, that might appear in an N by P by year interaction. And we don't.
I see.
I didn't toy around a whole lot with, like, the reason, so we have 2011, which is the first year of nutrient additions as its own analysis period. And then we grouped 2012 through 2014 together. The reason for that was that 2011 was so distinct from 2012 through 2014, like in terms of the in effect that we saw during that time. So I did do a little, you know, manipulating to try to match years, like, thoughtfully. But I think there's room to try to figure out a better way to do that, whether that's just like trial and error or, you know, some statistical method that allows you to figure that out.
Anybody want to raise a different topic?
So I have another sort of overarching question. It seems as if the young stands are the most responsive in all ways. There's sometimes you're seeing a significant phosphorus, or at least a suggestion of a phosphorus effect in the young stands. And then the nitrogen effect is by far strongest in the young stands in the last few years. So is there, can you think of reasons why the young stands stand out in terms of their responsiveness? I mean, one possibility is there's only two of them, whereas you have 5 or 6 of these.
Right. Yeah. I C2 gives me a little bit of anxiety because it is so unique in terms of what we see it doing with soil respiration. Like, C2 values are just so high relative to others, especially lately. Wow. So I don't know. There's something to think about with C2 there. And
yeah, like they're also said, loaded with roots. It also has the highest root production.
C2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the biggest response.
The biggest response to like in root biomass?
Yeah, the treatments in biomass. Yeah. Both production and biomass.
Yeah.
So it could be just that it's not an age thing. It's a
C2 thing.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I'd be interested to see like what that means for microbes too. Like what does C2 look like relative to other stands in that regard? Claudia, I don't think you were doing your fungal community analysis in C2, were you?
Oh, no, I didn't go to the young stands, mostly to avoid C3, but that included C2 also.
Yeah.
Well, Melanie has good information about what potential end mineralization.
We do have the microbial data for all the stands. The data aren't analyzed yet, but the data exists.
Oh, how was it collected, Tim? Sorry, this is a sideline, but
This is Shan's root samples. So she analyzed the root species composition, and she analyzed the root fungal composition.
I'm going to call on Claudia next because I saw she had a question, but I just want to point out to those of you not intimately familiar with these stands, I love it when people can say, oh, but C8 has high phosphorus, especially in plot 3, or C2 has the highest root production. It's so helpful to interpreting our results that there's a micro community of people who can have these conversations together. So to those of you eavesdropping, I just want, it sounds weird, but it's really valuable.
One point in that regard to make is that this is unusual to do this for 13 stands. You know, at Harvard Forest, they had one stand. And most of these studies haven't been, had huge, very large replication treatments.
Yeah, so thank you for the ambitious study. Claudia.
My question is about another unique aspect of the Melnahe project, which is the experience that graduate students get leading field crews. And Thomas, you and I got to share a unique experience of leading field crews during the early days of the pandemic. And so I'm curious what your greatest takeaway, lesson learned from leading a field crew is, and then as a follow-up to that, what is the greatest lesson learned from leading a field crew during a pandemic?
In case we ever need to lead field
crews. Yes, in case we need to know for the future.
Well, Joe on the call here, I have complete faith that he's going to do a great job leading the field crew this summer. I'll start off with that because I do think that we learned quite a bit last summer. About managing field crews in general. I feel like both summers.
That's a polite way of saying that the pandemic was the least of their challenges last summer.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah, that's what I want to say. I hadn't figured out that that's what I wanted to say, but that's it. Yeah, we had some major like social dynamics that were challenging last summer. And I would say even the first summer, but first summer was nothing compared to the last. I don't know. Being intentional about like community development is important, and being intentional going into the summer about making sure that the people you're selecting will be up for community development. Those are important. As for doing it in a pandemic, yeah, that same thing goes, like making sure that the people you're selecting are up for, you know, being responsible in a pandemic, because we also had some challenges with that.
Thank you, Thomas. That was definitely insightful.
Are you leading field crews now?
No, we have interns coming this summer to the Holden Arboretum, but thankfully I won't. Not thankfully, I loved being a part of a field crew and I loved being a leader on a field crew, but thankfully for this summer, I don't have any leadership roles.
Yeah.
To think about being intentional, not only about your interview questions, about the workload, but the willingness to do community building activities and your want to form community is a really interesting insight that has not been a part of interview questions that I think that from the interviews that I've given. So I appreciate that, Thomas. Thank you.
Claudia, you weren't subjected to the cabbage question, or was that, that was invented after your time on our crew? There was a bizarre interview question that, I don't know, Alex came up with that was, one of your crew members is accusing you of not pulling your weight on the crew and because of your cabbage, the cabbage in your diet. What do you
do? Yes, actually, I think I overheard Alex Rice giving that interview question when I happened to be studying at her house. So I am familiar. I
don't know how effective it was. But yeah. Any other questions about science or other aspects of the Thomas's experience? How many measurements did you make and how many were in the total study?
I'm sorry, Ruth suggested that I have these answers.
I thought it'd be impressive.
Let me stop sharing my screen. We have like in the overall study, tens of thousands, and I contributed over 1,000 to that. So the soil respiration data set's massive.
Oh, here's one from Andy. If you did this experiment 30 years ago, do you think you would have gotten the same results in general and the NP relationship?
Yeah, I'm gonna share my screen again because I think something helpful might be there. Wanted to go back to navigating Zoom. I wanted to go back to this map of nitrogen deposition. This was from 2000. I believe I took this map from the year 2000. I'm not sure how far back this data from the NADP goes. What is that, National Atmospheric Deposition Program? But I found it interesting that our White Mountains up here were pretty safe from the horrors of nitrogen addition, at least in the year 2000. That's not to say that it wasn't happening before then. So if we were to do this 30 years ago, what, that's like shortly or right around when the Clean Air Act was being introduced. I could be totally wrong about that.
That'd be 50 years ago, but
50?
Okay, depends on the intent of Andy's question.
That's what the angle that I'm taking, right? Is like we've had less nitrogen added to the forest 30 years ago. And so the nitrogen effect would probably be the effect of nitrogen addition, I would expect, would be stronger 30 years ago. Would we see the phosphorus interaction as well?
Andy asks in the chat about the timing of peak N deposition, which was about 2000. So it's gone down considerably in the last 10, 15 years, but it was peaking around then.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess nitrogen moves quickly. So if it was 30 years ago, like we would have a lot of it, more than we do now. So maybe the nitrogen effect wouldn't be quite as strong. I think that's where I'm going to stand on this one.
That's a great concept to include in your discussion, ultimately. John is going to ask a question, or John's baby Lou is going to ask a question.
So Thomas, at the end, you made this distinction, this hypothetical distinction, at least, between plants' investment in making roots for the acquisition of nitrogen versus associating mycorrhizae for the acquisition of phosphorus. I tend to think of those as going together, like plants make more roots and that increases their mycorrhizal associations because they have more roots, make more roots. But that might depend on whether we're thinking about herbuscular or ectoval associations. So trees in your plots, I think, are variable, but are they lots of ectos? Are they lots of herbusculars? I know there's been some work about, like, are those roots highly colonized by mycorrhizae? Are there high colonization rates? I'm kind of questioning whether you should really be conceptualizing a plant making roots without associated mycorrhizae.
Yeah, I understand. So I'll start with, like, what I can say pretty confidently, which is that we do have a diversity across our stands as to, you know, AM versus EM. C2, the weirdo that we were talking about before, is pretty beachy, which is EM, I believe. Yeah. Sugar maple is, like, the pretty much only species in Jeffersbrook, which is AM, correct? Yeah. So thank you, Claudia, for affirming. So I think that, yeah, you could expect to see some differences based upon that. And it would be an interesting way to go about analyzing it, maybe by, like, basal area of one or the other. Yeah. And to your point about, like, they're building roots in order to acquire mycorrhizal associations anyway. It's a super fair point that, like, I don't know. I mean, I was kind of grasping at straws to figure out a way to find a mechanism to explain the N by P interaction. I don't know. I keep coming back to, like, photosynthetic efficiency under added P, maybe, which allows for greater allocation to roots, maybe. And that was the only way that I could, like, try to wrap that into what we saw.
We're approaching 5:00. This is a fascinating discussion. I won't shut anybody out of the room, but I think we should unmute, have a round of applause, or anybody who wants to stay on and congratulate Thomas privately in the chat.
Thanks, everybody.
Questions. At the defense next week. Thank you.
That was excellent, Thomas.
Thank you, Claudia.
Much.
Thanks for attending.
Bye, everybody. Sorry, I'm reading the.
Great job, Thomas.
Thanks, John.
Bye, soon. Thomas.
Bye, John.
Bye, Mom. Love you.
Love you. Try to get out of here.
I trapped. Dad's never gonna make it out.
Mom and Dad are both here.
Good job, dude.
We hey, got stuck. You. We don't. We're novice yourself. At this. We can't get out. I can't even show myself.
In the old days, this was like, you know, a live presentation, and parents couldn't beam in.
Great job, Thomas.
Hey, thanks, Dad.
Can you?
I'm yeah, we can see you. I was talking to Matt when I said show yourself because he was.
Pick it up. What are you waiting on?
Dad, you're not muted.
Oh, Matt's gone now. Okay.
I'll put a lady in there. Probably on speaker right now.
Yep.
I don't know what I'm going to leave and put Thomas in charge.
New tractor. You've been there. You got the address and stuff.
fine.
It's pretty classic stuff, folks. Oh.
I just muted that.
You muted that?
All right. Yes. We're talking about work.
I know. I couldn't figure out how to mute him.
Well, oh, I don't even know what, if I'm on, Michaela's gone. I got kicked off and back on. I don't know. It,